This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
If we had been a straight couple, then I would have gotten her Social Security. As it was, I didn't get anything.
Studies show that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer seniors are much more likely than their straight counterparts to be alone and isolated as they age. Housing and support for these elders is a growing need, and the issue is not just confined to the United States.
From a government's perspective, they are confused about whether to put them in the male or female older people's home.
On this edition, we'll visit Jakarta, Indonesia, and Los Angeles, California, to hear stories of building housing and community for LGBTQ seniors. I'm Jen Chien, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In recent years, much progress has been made in the fight for the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. You can see a lot of this shift reflected in popular media.
All this marriage equality news is so exciting. New York.
It's going to be insane. And Isabel's already consulting on like 7 different gay weddings.
It's historic.
From TV shows like Glee and Ellen.
So, on my show, what I like to do is I like to promote kindness and equal rights. And I don't like labels and I don't see color. I'm like a Cocker Spaniel in that way.
To pop stars like Frank Ocean, Scissor Sisters, and Lady Gaga.
Let's have a kiki.
I wanna have a kiki.
Lock the doors.
Right. Let's have a kiki.
But there's something missing from pop culture's portrayal of the LGBTQ community. With all the shiny young faces on display, LGBTQ elders have been relegated to the sidelines. Many of the cultural and political gains we see today are due to the efforts of a generation that's now aging, often in isolation and obscurity. According to research, LGBTQ elders are twice as likely to be single and 4 times as likely to be childless than their heterosexual counterparts. For those that are partnered, legal discrimination can mean difficulty accessing partner benefits, and many queer elders do not have good relationships with their families of origin. So, as they age, lifelines of support and care can dwindle. Fear of homophobia, discrimination, or abuse can lead many LGBTQ elders to stay isolated, even as they face difficulties with health care and with housing.
Very often, LGBT older adults find that they are not welcome in so-called mainstream aging programs, and so they don't have the sense of community that often comes with group-based social services. We also know, unfortunately, that even within the LGBT community itself, older people often feel isolated and don't find the sense of community that they need.
Michael Adams, executive director of SAGE, Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders, spoke in 2011 at the nation's first summit on LGBTQ housing issues.
We know that, in general, LGBT older folks face particular challenges, and we can lump those challenges into 3 general areas in terms of stigma, being disconnected from traditional family structures, and in terms of unequal treatment under the law. What all of those factors build toward is, in many cases, particularly heightened sense of an experience of isolation among LGBT older people, which heightens the importance of community and place. So for LGBT elders, it's fair to say that welcoming and supportive housing is not just a luxury, it's in fact a necessity. And it goes beyond the particulars of housing and a roof over one's head into what's important in terms of providing community for many people who, as they age, find that in very short supply.
Awareness of the need for affordable and culturally competent care is growing, with housing developments for LGBTQ elders in the works in multiple cities. We go now to Los Angeles, where in 2007, a nonprofit called Gay and Lesbian Elder Housing built the nation's first affordable housing development for LGBTQ seniors. It's called Triangle Square. Reporter Lena Nozizwe visited the 5-story apartment complex, and she brings us this story.
Hello, Rosie.
It's snack time for Rosie. And to the casual observer, this domestic scene between a doting cat owner and her fat and furry feline is nothing more than ordinary. Only the blonde-haired woman with a twinkle in her eye and cat food in her hand believes it's more like a miracle.
My name is Alice Hope Herman. I'm 77 years old. I lived with my partner, Sylvia, for 45 years. She died 3 months, almost to the day, before I found my home here at Triangle Square.
Triangle Square in Hollywood, California, is the country's first affordable housing complex designed specifically with lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, seniors in mind. It was built in 2007, just a couple of blocks away from the fabled intersection of Hollywood and Vine. The 10-year waiting list to get a spot at Triangle Square is not surprising, considering that there are an estimated 3 million LGBT seniors 65 years or older in the United States. That number is expected to grow by another million by 2030, numbers that only highlight the need for places like Triangle Square.
That's Sylvia when she was younger.
Very Audrey Hepburn.
Triangle Square is not at all where she imagined that she would end up back in the mid-60s when an uptown Alice began a relationship with a downtown Sylvia in New York City.
When Sylvia and I started out, she had pretty much grown up from the time she was around 17 in Greenwich Village. She knew the bar scene. She used to go out with the guys in the mafia. I didn't know there were gay people in Greenwich Village. I didn't know what a gay person was. I got married. Okay. And I married my high school sweetheart. And 2 years after we were married, I realized I was gay, but I didn't know what it meant. So I was what they called uptown, because I went to college. I went to libraries. Sylvia went to after-hours clubs and bars. I mean, two completely different worlds. I gave her what she needed, which was stability. To her, I was like a rock. To me, she was like a cloud.
The cloud spent a lifetime ascending in the business world and became a successful chief financial officer in the garment district, while the rock, Alice, was a teacher and then a social worker. She says they were successful enough that after 40-plus years together, they managed to put $500,000 in the bank, and she says they created a beautiful home in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. But then in 2007, Sylvia fainted in their home and was hospitalized.
And what she would ever say to me is, Alice, just let me come home, please. I just want to come home.
This couple, who had already been together in sickness and in health, got married by a rabbi in the hospital. Days later, Sylvia died.
If we had been a straight couple, then I would have gotten her Social Security, which I can say was more than twice as much as mine, which is what you get when you're a straight couple. The partner gets the higher of the two checks. As it was, I didn't get anything.
Hospital bills decimated their savings. Alice was forced to leave the home they shared, and given her age and income, it was difficult to find housing. But then through word of mouth, she found out about Triangle Square, and it was exactly what she was looking for. She says it's safe, affordable, and allows her to keep the cats, including Rosie, that she once shared with her beloved Sylvia.
My birth name is Wayne, and I go under Miss Rosie. I am transgender, and I live at Triangle Square, and I am 72 years old.
Another Rosie, more specifically, Miss Rosie, also found shelter at Triangle Square. It was not the death of a partner, but intolerant neighbors who brought Miss Rosie to Triangle Square, also in 2007. The transgender senior got tired of sneering neighbors.
I lived over near Gower and Hollett and Sunset. And I was there for 30 years. But when I'd go get dressed up in my apartment and walk down the hall, I'd get looks and sneered at and everything. And, you know, it just made me feel uncomfortable.
Once she moved into Triangle Square, she immediately felt at home. Her one-bedroom apartment is now complete with enough wigs to make Dolly Parton envious.
Right here is my little short one here that's my Susan Boyle look.
And there are his and hers closets.
One female a closet and one male closet.
I have a hard enough time with just a female closet.
The kind of acceptance Miss Rosie has found at Triangle Square, no matter what she wears, has been a long time coming. That was not the case where she grew up in Indiana.
When I was a child, I used to dress up my mom's clothes up in the attic. And sometimes I'd get punished by my parents, and then I would get mad. And I said, well, I want to run away home to become a woman, you know, and disappear as a man.
As it turns out, she grew up and ran away to the military. She didn't have the Susan Boyle wig back then, so it was with a mop on her head that she impersonated a woman during an Army talent show. And she won. In 1964, after 5 years of military service, Miss Rosie decided to make the full transition to living as a woman after a visit to a bar.
I was telling the barmaid about the situation I did in the Army. She said, come over to my house and I'll dress you up. And when she dressed me up with the real makeup, real hair, the whole works, I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, oh my God, this is really me. I thought I was just an ordinary homosexual or queer at that time. I did not even know the word what gay was, you know, and or transgender or anything like that.
Miss Rosie says there weren't many jobs in the 60s for a newly minted woman, and that's what she says led her to the streets of San Francisco.
In this dirty old part of the city.
And when I was doing this, while I was going through the transitioning, I had no job, and I was a prostitute back in the 60s. And guys that I'd pick up thinking I'm a real woman.
Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty.
And then when they get down to the nitty-gritty, they would find out that I'm a man, and I've had guns on me, I've had knives pulled on me. It's a wonder I'm still alive today.
She survived San Francisco and then Los Angeles until she says she quit prostitution after a police beating during a bust. In 2001, she would face another serious threat to her life, HIV.
Is I take 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pills per day at one time in the mornings.
And just as Miss Rosie survived the streets, she says she will survive HIV.
I am not going to let HIV or anything to stop me from doing anything that I want to do.
As many as a third of the apartments at Triangle Square are devoted to seniors who are HIV positive. Because of their health status, those seniors get preferential treatment when they apply to be residents. The nonprofit Gay and Lesbian Elder Housing, or GLEH, runs Triangle Square and provides other services there, including nutrition guidance, financial planning, and recreational activities.
I'm given activities that based in community, we go to the theater, we go wherever, go to museums and to Chinatown or wherever, or to the beach, you know. And it's
a person has to have a link so that their mind stays alive.
The link to life on this night is a gathering of Triangle Square residents, supporters, and administrators.
Well, welcome everybody.
The event is focused on fundraising, but it is also an opportunity for Eric Harrison, the executive director of GLEH, to celebrate the pioneering success of Triangle Square.
You know, we have had such a tremendous amount of support this past year.
Resident Alice Herman shows just how important Triangle Square is to her as she mixes and mingles with the fundraising crowd and tries her luck at the community room's pool table.
Did you get it in?
These places are needed. It's hard to get old in many ways. It's more difficult to be old and gay, especially when you've lived a life where you've been hurt because you were gay, where you've been frowned on or hurt or beat up or arrested. Look at the things that have happened to people. At least here they can walk through the halls and know they're safe.
This is a beautiful place, just a beautiful place to be, you know?
Ms. Rosie, who's lived through arrest and beating, says she never wants to leave this safety zone.
And this, I'm hoping that this will be the last place I ever be, because I love this place.
I get to tell my story over and over again. When you get to be my age, or maybe even when you're younger, you've got a history, you've got a life. The one person you shared your history with is no longer there. What happens to the history? What happens to the life I had? How does it stay alive if it's only inside me, in my head? Here I get to tell my story.
Alice and Miss Rosie are sharing their histories in a place that's making history of its own. For Making Contact, I'm Lena Nozizwe.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear about a unique housing project for transgender seniors in Jakarta, Indonesia.
If you'd like more information or for a CD copy of this program, please call 510-251-1332, extension 108. That's 510-251-1332. Extension 108. Because of generous donations from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or to get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
We'll head now to Indonesia, where just as in the U.S., LGBTQ elders face unique challenges as they age. Traditionally, elderly people in Indonesia are cared for by their families, but that's not the case for the country's large transgender community. They're often rejected by their family members, and many elderly transgender people who used to survive as prostitutes end up begging on the streets. In response, a group of women decided to take action and are building a home specifically for elderly transgender residents. From Jakarta, Rebecca Henschke reports. This story was originally broadcast on Free Speech Radio News.
We're walking down a dirt road up to a very small pink house at the end of the alleyway. It's a very suburban part of Jakarta, on the outskirts of the city. There are chickens running around and children playing, and it's a very dusty road. It's here that Indonesia's first old people's home for transgender people, or waria as they're known in Indonesia, is being built.
Selamat pagi.
Selamat pagi.
Selamat siang.
In the doorway, two elderly transgender women whose teeth are missing call out good morning. Inside, Julianus Retteblaut is looking into a mirror while a friend is going through the daily ritual of applying her heavy makeup. Thick white foundation, fake eyelashes, bright red lipstick, and a long black wig that is tied into a bun at the back.
I realized that I was a transgender person when I was in grade 5 at school. I lived in a village in an isolated area on the island of Papua. There was no one there that was transgender or gay. But suddenly, I started feeling attracted to men when I was around 11 years old. I thought, what is this feeling? Is it an illness? It was not till I was 18 years old when a friend at university, who was also transgender, took me to Jakarta to the prostitution beat for Waria, that I realized that there was this whole other world that existed. I was so confused. There were so many people like me dressed up so beautifully.
How did you feel when you realized you were not alone?
I felt like weight had been lifted from me because I saw that if we wear beautiful clothes and got makeup, you could easily attract guys and be paid money for it. So you get satisfied, get to be beautiful, and you earn money.
Transgender people in Indonesia find it hard to find jobs. And 17-year-old Yuli ended up doing what many other warriors do, working as a prostitute on the streets, a world she says was harsh and violent. She says she was regularly abused and not paid by customers, and they had to run away from the police or Islamic vigilante groups that tried to beat them. It was during this time that she heard her parents had died.
I didn't go home for the funeral because my family hated me. They said because of what I had done, my parents had died.
My brother is a policeman. He was very angry and he wanted to shoot me because he said I had shamed my family.
They said, in our family, we have never had anyone like you. How could you turn out like this?
Because my family had high hopes for me because I got very good grades all through school.
Your brother was really prepared to shoot you?
Yes, he's put a pistol to my head and he wanted to shoot. They shaved my head, but I managed to run away back to Jakarta. I really hated myself at that time and I decided that I would spend the rest of my life showing the world and particularly my family that even though I'm transgender, I can do good and they would be proud of me.
She went on to be the first warrior to gain a law degree at a leading Islamic university and is now doing her master's in law. She's now a high-profile leader of Indonesia's large transgender community, who fondly call her Mama Yuli. As a mother to the community, she decided she needed to do something to support graying warrior, rejected by their family and society.
Orang akan memang merasa lebih takut.
As they get older, people become even more scared of warrior. We can't sell ourselves in the same way young warrior can. From a government's perspective, they are confused about whether to put them in the male or female older people's home. And the families certainly do not want to look after them. So I see many of them struggling, begging on the streets, living under bridges. I really feel sad seeing them like that. And no one is paying attention to this issue. And my house was not big enough to house many.
So she's now renovating her two-bedroom house that also doubles as a beauty salon. Yuli takes me out the back of the house where building is taking place. A second floor is being put on and the bathroom is being extended. She already has a waiting list of 800 warrior who want to move in. At the moment, the house is home to three elderly warrior. Photos of them as young, beautiful models line the walls, and cabinets are full of their beauty pageant trophies. Yoti Maya is nearly 70 years old and has lost all her teeth. She was disowned by her family when she was a teenager.
Ibu buka pintu, ada laki dalam, waktu lagi peluk-pelukan. Ibu tuh gak mau ribut, bilang ke ayah saya.
My mother opened my door and found me in bed cuddling with a man. And she told my dad, and he called all my family together and said, I don't want this in my family, so you must leave the house now. If you lived or died, I don't care. You just have to get out of the house.
16-17 tahun saya keluar lah, sama si Mia tuh. Saya keluar dari rumah.
I was just a teenager and they threw me out of the house at night with nothing but the clothes I was wearing. I was crying. I was young and I didn't have a job. But I accepted my fate.
Yorty says she eventually found work as a chef on ships and has traveled across Asia. She's now the cook for the nursing home. The home also holds training sessions for elderly transgender people so they can get skills to live independently.
Hello, nama saya Mbak Sri.
73-year-old Mbak Sri teaches sewing and warns the younger waria that they can't live off their looks forever.
Semua waria yang muda,
I tell them all young waria need to get formal education in their chosen field. No one else is going to be looking after us. We need to create our own profession and provide for ourselves.
Sri says the three of them, despite their age, remain young at heart. She jokes that Yoti Maya has four boyfriends, and they hold a weekly karaoke night where the elderly waria take turns performing their favourite tracks. Yuli's positive contributions to the community are making an impact beyond the transgender community. Recently, her brother, who had threatened to shoot her, visited the old people's home.
He did not come in, but just walked around and he started to cry. He said, I never thought you would change and become a good person. It doesn't matter that you are a warrior, but you have become a role model for your community and you're providing a home for those in your community in need. Our family is very proud of you, he said.
Terus dia bilang bahwa
we couldn't accept you as a prostitute, terjadi, but you have become terjadi, a good person.
Aku sebagai kakaknya juga bangga. Seperti itu. Dan kemudian
he said that the past was the past, but as a brother, I'm very proud of you. A few days later, I had my law graduation, and he came along. He couldn't say anything at the celebration. He couldn't speak because he was just crying. Not long after that, he died. I went to his funeral, and he had left me a message that I must continue to be a good person.
Yuli, Yoti, and Sri continue their efforts to support aging transgender people. And recently, they received a grant from the Indonesian government so that they could complete the first floor of the old people's home. In Jakarta, Indonesia, I'm Rebecca Henschke.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups.
And through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation.
To promote the study of political and economic problems.
And of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. This bridge called my back. It's an amazing celebration. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's been 40 years since the groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color, edited by Sherry Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa, was first published. Today, we're honored to be joined by co-editor Sherry Moraga, who's an iconic Chicana writer, feminist activist, poet, essayist, and playwright. And also joining me as a guest co-host today is Wanda Alacon, who's an assistant professor of practice in gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona. Welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Cherie, for listeners who may not be familiar with the anthology or who may need a reminder, can you just start by telling us about some of the stellar contributors and describing just a little bit of like the depth and the breadth of the voices and visions included in this amazing anthology?
Well, that's kind of a huge question.
Yeah.
You know, originally, I guess what I have to say is when we started this project in the late 70s, Gloria and I were very unpublished writers. Mm-hmm. And so when you're saying you were sort of the kind of like best known figures, et cetera, I think it's important to say is that our initial impetus to do this had very little to do with that. It had very little to do with people necessarily that were well known, but we ended up getting some very key Black feminist support at that time. And the people that come to my mind right now are, of course, Audre Lorde, Toni K. Bambara, who wrote the foreword, and Barbara Smith, who was a key member of the Combahee River Collective. So those Black sisters, you know, really, and locally, and I say locally because I was in the Bay Area at that time, Pat Parker, many people that aren't aware of Pat Parker's work, but just fierce Black lesbian writer, and very connected with Audre Lorde. So they were like these key, really important figures for us, because when Gloria Anzaldu and I decided to do this collection, it was really because we had been very involved in working as poets more than anything else, you know, in the burgeoning women of color cultural movement in the late 70s in the greater Bay Area, San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland. And through our doing this, you know, work, we were meeting a lot of other women of color writers, in particular Asian American women like Jenny Lim and Nellie Wong, Merle Wu, and beginning to try to also cultivate relations with Native writers. One in particular in the Bay Area was Barbara Cameron. So people that know the book can also know now that some of those writers like Christos, has many of the writers now in the book have national reputations. The people that had the national reputation at that time, as I said, was largely African-American women. So for them, you know, we had this idea of responding to what we understood was what we experienced very kind of brutally, the racism of the white women's movement at that time, and its exclusion, its racism and classism of women of color writers and thinkers and activists. And so the book was originated out of that impulse. But once we started it, it went someplace, not entirely different, because there's still a lot of critique of those issues, which remains the case in many ways. But what it did is it really gave us an opportunity as women of color from very diverse communities to finally speak together in between the covers of a book. And so what I always credit, you know, Audre and Barbara and, you know, Toni Cade, is they could see they were called to also communicate with us. And by virtue of their visibility, it gave all these other women of color to visibility. And so I always remain really, you know, very beholden and grateful to them for that, because in a certain way there was a women of color movement happening, at least, you know, really from the mid-70s, really, that was intercultural, but it didn't have that much visibility. Because there wasn't that much being documented about it. There was a Third World Women's Alliance that was also in the Bay Area and in New York. They were amazing. And they had, you know, they had began a publication. And so there was all this stuff burgeoning, you know. But somehow it was this particular book that seems to have lasted over time. 40 years, yeah, you're right. It's a long time.
It's, yeah, amazing. And it's such a rich mixture. I mean, there's personal essays, criticism, interviews, testimonials, and also poetry and visual art. So it's this multi-layered book. And Wanda, just to bring you in, what was your first impression, and I've heard from so many folks and seen so many clips online from people saying how much the book changed their lives. So I wanted to hear from you, you know, before you start bringing in some of your questions, how that was for you.
Absolutely. The book is so fundamentally important to my thinking and everything that I do. And I write about Chicana literature. That's primarily what I do. My framework is woman of color feminisms and decolonial feminist thought, you know, kind of together. And so that's kind of an unusual combination for some, because there seems to be this sort of like, if you write about Chicana anything, literature, right? Then therefore the theories that inform your thinking is Chicana feminism, right? And that's part of the picture. But I find that we lose a lot when we do not think of Chicana feminisms as being part of coalitional histories with women of color, right? And so in that sense, it is a really fundamental, large, important framework for my thinking that requires both decolonial feminist thinking and women of color feminism. But to answer that first question, Lynn, I have to say, and I was wondering, Sheree, if how it feels to you to imagine, and maybe you got this reception as well, but when I first encountered the book myself, you know, I had trouble with the cover, with the image. I have to say that my response was not warm. I had a hard time with that. And so seeing this figure, a drawing of a woman nude on all fours, you know, and this idea of the bridge, I'm like, oh, I struggled with that. And so I don't want to say I fought it, but, you know, but I did resent it. You know, and what helped me so much was reading Tona K. Bambara, all the forewords, you know, but also the Kate Russian poem, you know, the bridge poem, because it captures that exhaustion, like, because we so often do not have the choice. You know, we are the bridges in our families, you know, we are the bridges in our communities. I had to kind of work my way through the politics of bridge. Yeah.
Well, so now that, you know, the 2002 version has Ana Mendieta's image.
Yes.
And the since 2015, the back is standing up. And the back is made of corn. And that was an image right on. Yeah. And that's the new version has that too, of the different color. But the corn, the spine, it wasn't until 2002 that the visual images, you know, the multiple visual images in color came in, and those were curated by Celia Herrera Rodriguez. Yeah. And so that idea of the spine also being made of corn representing indigenous women was pretty significant. And if you see there's a drawing of it. And it really is that. So I love that you had that reaction to the cover. And what's also cool is that if you, I asked Kate Russian, you know, to read that poem again, and, you know, some of the work is live and some of the work was pre-recorded for the event. And she read it in a way I've never heard her read it in my life. What was really impressive to me about it is I remember her reading it as of 40 years ago. So she was a lot younger. And she had all this, like, you know, kind of like all this, you know, youthful energy. Like, I always remember the line where she'd say, I've done more translating than the goddamn UN, being all pissed off, but, you know, spirited, right? And now her anger is deep. Mm-hmm. It is deep because it's, you know, I'm not sure exactly, but I know the Kate's around my age. So it's like at least late 60s. Deep as a Black woman, you know, and it's impressive to me. It's impressive. In other words, that, you know, like when you really think about those pieces, that's been an interesting thing to kind of go back and be able to record some of the sisters from the original and just seeing the depth and the complexity of what they know now. So the bridge and that idea of this bridge called My Back really just came, you know, it had come to me when I was in when I was in Boston, where I originally met Barbara Smith and some of the women from Babahi. And I happened to, and it was funny, so I wrote that piece, This Bridge Gets Walked Over, This Bridge Called My Back, you know, and then many, you know, a little while later, Kate had this poem, the bridge poem. It wasn't written for the book. It was like she had it. So it's like, it just was perfect, you know, it's like collective thinking.
That is a wonderful, I am so curious about the formation of it, you know, how it came to be. And that's actually the question I had, you know, did you ask Donna for the poem or was it already, you know, there? So you've in a way kind of answered one of my secret questions, you know.
It's not a secret.
Sheree, I love how you said that the 2015 edition, that the illustrations that accompany all the subsections now were curated by Celia, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And so one of the things that I like to, when I teach a class called U.S. Rural Feminisms mm-hmm. Regularly. It's one that I teach. I also teach the Gateway, the Introduction to Gender Studies class. And so there is always a unit or two units on Bridge. So I'm always teaching Bridge and always trying to find different ways of introducing it or presenting it to students, you know? Mm-hmm. And so one way with my kind of lit background is I, you know, the form of it, right? You know, how people have, scholars of Bridge have called it, it's a history or it's an event or it's an archive, you know, that it's not just an anthology. It is an anthology, yes, but it is also historical, an event, some say performance, an archive. I propose it's a soundscape, you know, all these ways of capturing, you know, a coalitional politics, right, you know. And Cindy Cruz would say it's a primer, right, because there's a pedagogy to Bridge, you know, right. And to that, we can now add a gallery, right? And I am curious about the drawings, you know, like they're very compelling. The ones in the first editions, you know, the black and white, like bus stop, like I'm yeah. just so moved by these images, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wondered how you was it a difficult move to go from that kind of history of Bridge to mm-hmm. now featuring, of course, the very important work of these artists of color in the editions.
Yeah, the idea, I mean, somebody could do a study on every edition of Bridge. I mean, the first, within 2 years, the book was redone by Kitchen Table Women of Color Press. That we had to wrest the book from the original publishers, Persephone Press, which in the beginning they were wonderful to work with, a white feminist press that had really distributed the book very widely. But when it really came down to it and we wanted rights to the book back because the press was falling apart, it wasn't an easy move. I mean, we had to get lawyers, we had to do all of the typical white capitalist patriarchal stuff, you know. But when we did it, we really wanted to keep the book in print. We moved quickly. And so partly, the book is pretty much like the initial, including the artwork. And one of the ideas is that at that time, when we were doing the book and we were working with Persephone, was basically trying to find, you know, a woman of color who could do the illustrations. And Janetta Tinker was there. And I mean, I guess she was a Boston, I'm trying to think, she must have been a Boston-based artist. And, you know, she had these beautiful drawings. But by the time we got to 2002, and the book went out of print for a period of time, because after Kitchen Table Press was no longer functioning, then the book went out of print. And then Third Woman Press out of Berkeley, and Norma Alarcón was a publisher of Third Woman Press coming out of UC Berkeley. And she, you know, we all knew each other, right? We all knew each other. And Celia had always said, you know, why is it we don't have, you know, this is another language. The visual is another language. Why don't we have representation of the visual artists from that period of time? And she was really right, you know? So we said, okay, do it. So she went and did it. So actually, if you have the 2002 version, that has a whole, you know, centerpiece that has much more work and it's all in color. And when we went to SUNY Press, we wanted that again, but they wouldn't, you know, the cost, right? It's always cost stuff, right? But that work is there now and it is and it does represent a much wider group of artists than the later versions has. But it really is the whole point was, you know, as we're talking about the writers of 1981, who were the visual artists of that period, and Celia, as a visual artist, also has, you know, contextualized that work. And what's also been really kind of hard and interesting about it is that are the number of people that have passed, and so, particularly the visual artists like Ana Mendieta, and Teresa, I can never say her name correctly, I'm sorry. But there are, you know, people that passed really early deaths, and there's reference also to Victoria Mercado and Marcia Gomez, and a lot of them died early deaths. So having them there and having them within the context of women of color feminism was really important. I thought the idea to have Ana Mendieta on the 2002 cover was brilliant, you know, just brilliant. And so, you know, but the other people said, oh, no, we need to bring back the body. And, you know, everybody's got ideas, you know. So it's all good. I mean, it's all good. But I think that since you're talking about scholars, I mean, that's something to look at, is to really look at all the editions and see what they say about us, you know, about women of color movement, about our expressions, et cetera.
I'm also really interested in talking about something that you mentioned in the 2015 edition, about the concept of political memory. And you wrote, in order to ensure that we are not always reimagining ourselves, the ever inventors of our revolution, how each edition brings that question back. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one thing with all the editions, even since 1983, one of the titles of one of the prefaces that I did was called Refugees of a World on Fire. And what I'm finding, it's not hard. What I'm finding is everything, I'm just speaking for myself here, that but in contextualizing each of the editions, they seem prophetic and they're not. They're just true. You know, and I guess that's the horror of it, really, on a certain level. Because if in 82 you can talk about the world being refugees of a world on fire, where are we now? So there's a way in which that the 2001 version, I wrote 2001, which and that title was From Inside the First World. I began writing it on the morning of 9/11, because that happened to be the day that I had put aside to write, right? You know, you have it on your calendar, I'm just going, oh, today's my writing day. And we woke up to the giving our kids breakfast, you know, and as we had the news on in the morning and we're seeing the Twin Towers go, right? And so, and the first thing you think, you look at it and you say, you know, the U.S. is completely complicit. That's the first thing that comes to your mind. You know, you're a conscious human being and your kids are looking at it. My son's like 8 and he's looking at it and he asks me, who are the bad guys? Who are the bad guys? I don't get it. Who are the bad guys? You know, and it's like, and I go, good question. Good question. This is where we start, you know. So the point being is that every single time there was a new edition, you know, there was something else. I look at them and there's always like this little litany kind of goes on. What are the current issues, you know? And so then you're talking about the war in El Salvador at one period of time. You're talking about, you know, so it's like each time, you know, then there was the Occupy movement. And so there's progressive things that are happening at the same time. Progressive responses, but by and large, the degree to which you can mark in those forewords and prefaces and, you know, all the things that they're called, the introductions, the degree you can mark really, really the deterioration of what we understand really as true democracy, not all the language of it, but, and also, of course, the condition of the planet. So by this version now, the one thing I found myself with this preface, I had a really hard time with it because we were coming out of Black Lives Matter and we're not coming out of anything, but I'm saying, but still, and pandemic, like all of these things are on the street and, you know, the disproportionate amount of people of color being impacted by that and women of color being impacted. Everything is quite evident that was 40, you're supposed to write something that's 40 years later. And each time I have to admit, sometimes I'm less and less optimistic. It's like I always have, it's like, you know, as you know, I write theater, you know, and so a lot of times people say to me, you know, like sometimes they're sad. They're really sad. You know, I mean, it's like there's tragedy, right? And they'll say, why do you write tragedies? I said, if you look at the tragedies, like inside of it, they're not tragic because there's always movement. There's always this place in which that, like opening that wound, you know, helps you realize what we need to do to get well, right? And so I had felt this way, this particular writing, because I just returned back to Christos's last line of the book, which is, I will be screaming, no, no more destruction in that last blinding light. And that was in 1981, right? She's saying that then. Is she a prophet? Of course she's a prophet. But we're all prophets. You know what I'm saying? If you're paying attention, it doesn't have to, you know, you see what's coming down the road. And I think that that's why Bridge still works. Because these were very, very conscienced women, speakers, who were writing, not as academics. In fact, the first things that we got, we were from academics, because academics at that time were the only people who thought they could write in terms of women of color, right? And we just turned them back. We gave them back. We didn't want that. So when you're talking about the testimonials and you're talking about, you know, I mean, some of like Rosario Morales's pieces are some of the best pieces in the book, Puerto Ricanía. And hers, she sent them to me handwritten. I can't write. This is why I can't write. She writes all this stuff. And we just pulled it out, used it, you know, and you know, say Gloria Christos's pieces. And so all mm-hmm. I want to say is about the remembering and why it's important to know the histories, right? Because the truth of the matter is, and I teach young people, I'm still teaching 20-year-olds, you know, I mean, it's like I've been doing it for 40 years. And the longer you teach, you realize how deeply the amnesia is, you know. And without that body of knowledge, right, they always have to start from scratch. And it's too late to start from scratch. The condition of this world is too late to start from scratch, you know. And they have to know what happened before them and the tools that were used then. Why create new tools, you know? It's because these were not the master's tools that were being used. You know, Audrey said, don't use the master's tools. They will not dismantle the master's tools. But we didn't use the master's tools. And partly the writing is not the master's tools, because it is visceral. It is theory in the flesh. It is coming out of lived experience, right? Now we have tons of academic language for it. But it doesn't necessarily mean we're any closer to knowing what that means, right, in terms of relationship to heart knowledge.
This is such music to my ears, Cherie, because I also teach 19, 20-year-olds. And so what I find helps me, I think it is important to kind of examine the form and the way Bridge takes up, you know, a form that is the anthology that has been used to authorize a particular kind of writing, particular kind of knowledge, right? And the way it takes up the form, but in this radical anti-canonical way, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that kind of helps me, yes, it is kind of highly periodized for some people, you know, to a certain decade, right? You know, but the way I approach it is to have students, and this is where listening helps me tune into kind of like the ongoing reverberations or the influence of the work that Bridge did, right? And so, for instance, a concept like intersectionality right now from the Combahee River Collective's, you know, Black Feminist Statement, right? Young people understand in a very popular sense a definition or an understanding of intersectionality. You know, so they already know that, you know, they already kind of, that is part of kind of like what shows up on their social media, you know, sort of readings, right? And so I know that young people are feeling the influence of Bridge. And so part of my work is to kind of have context, historical context, right? You know, for like where Bridge came out, you know, alongside with anthologies like But Some of Us Are Brave or Making Waves, kind of its contemporaries, right? Mm-hmm. But then also to not think, well, just because it's got this specific publication date, right, that we cannot see the lasting work of Bridge. So this is all to say I'm into the idea of reverberations. And what helps me with that is M. Jackie Alexander, who devotes a chapter in her book, Pedagogies of Crossing, mm-hmm. called Remembering This Bridge Called My Back, Remembering mm-hmm. Ourselves, right? And so she's, you know, a Caribbean feminist, right? And so she says this, I was not part of the sweat and fire that birthed a woman of color politics in this country in the 1970s and 1980s. This is why I want to remember that I have been shaped by it. And she writes about sharing what she calls a politicized non-belonging with the writers in Bridge, you know? And so this is kind of to echo the Lynn's question about the political memory, right? You know, but this is sort of one of the ways, the kind of the links that I try to show students that we are all, like, I mean, I am older than my students, but I also was not part of that movement, right? Mm-hmm. I encountered these ideas, politics, you know, through Bridge itself, the materiality of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I see many reverberations of the concept of solidarity expressed in, say, US-Third World, like connected to the third world, right? You know, the concept of theory in the flesh, which for many people now, theories of embodiment, right, is kind of how they understand that concept in part. You know, there's all these new coalitions, right? But one of the most important concepts for me is the theory meeting the practice, you know, and specifically through the writing. And I love that in the 2015 introduction that Catching Fire, you insist like writing that continues to be this tool like of liberation, right, for women of color. And so I'm struck by the not just the kind of writing that there is, but there's also like forms that are important in Bridge. Like there's so many letters in Bridge. And there's also the many sort of daughter-mother writings.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine, and we're talking to Sheree Moraga, co-editor of This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color, and Wanda Alakon is our guest host today. And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine, and thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, @feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
This is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase here on KPFK. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it. Hello, beautiful souls and cosmic travelers. Support for KPFK comes in part from the band Definitely Dead, a Grateful Dead tribute band performing Friday, June 12th at Del Mar Social, located at 3444 Trip Court in San Diego, California, and Saturday, June 13th at the El Rey Theater in Los Angeles. Doors open at 7 p.m. and both shows begin at 8 p.m. Further information and tickets are available at definitelydead.com, kpfk.org, and Definitely Dead Band on Facebook. So gather your beautiful people, follow the dancing lights, and let the music carry you into the stars.
You're invited to tune in to The QR Code with your hosts, Ramses Ja and Q Ward.
The Q in The QR Code goes by the name of Q Ward.
The voice you just heard is the R in The QR Code. He goes by the name Ramses Ja.
Every Monday through Thursday at 6 a.m.
Be sure to join us next time as we share our news with our voice from our perspective. And until then,
peace.